I guess I'll start this off. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here, and then, of course, our panel. I think I'm pretty excited about having this panel together to actually give a San Diego or Southern California twist to some of the activities that have been going on in terms of productizing some of the research that you've heard about this morning, and, of course, you hear about going to the various conferences that are held around the globe. So we have a pretty high-powered panel here today. I'll let the folks introduce themselves and a little bit more about their companies in just a minute. But here we have Jeffrey Janis from International Stem Cell, Alan Lewis, the famous Alan Lewis from Novacell, Kai Pinkernel from Cytori, and then Steve Letterman from Agilent. So with that, what I will ask each of the panelists to do is probably provide a little bit of an overview of themselves and their companies, about 2 or 3 minutes or so, and then we'll get into actual discussion. So, Jeffrey, do you want to start off?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Joydeep. My name is Jeffrey Janis. I'm the president of International Stem Cell and the CEO of Lifeline Cell Technology. We are a company that's been is based in three locations. We are in Maryland, and we are in California. We've recently set up a manufacturing facility for our and a research facility in Oceanside. Our company, my background is in developing products for what we call normal human cell products. I go back to the Clonetics days, making the Clonetics brand of media and cells products. We're using a lot of the same technologies to move into the stem cell arena, develop products in that area for research use. We also have a very strong research team that comes from Russia through our interactions and collaborations with scientists in Moscow. We've recently made some discoveries in the area of parthenogenesis to develop new lines of we call parthenogenic stem cells, which seem to be very, very close to embryonic stem cells. And I'm happy to say that many of those scientists from Russia are coming to our Oceanside research facility, and we're going to be expanding that work into the fields of retinal, derivation of retinal cells, cells to treat diabetes, and cells to treat liver disease.
Thanks. Okay, well, I'm infamous Alan Lewis. I don't think I'm famous, but anyway. I'm actually the president and CEO of Novacell here in San Diego, and like Jeff, we have a facility elsewhere in a place called Athens in Georgia on the campus of the University of Georgia. We're probably one of the oldest human embryonic stem cell companies in San Diego, for sure. It used to be a little company called Cythera some years ago that actually merged with Novacell that was in Irvine at the time. The company really has three platforms. First of all, we call ourselves a stem cell engineering company, which basically means we try to directly differentiate cells to the ultimate cell, which is going to be used for a cell therapy. And we were probably one of the first companies that would be able to create the endoderm in vitro. And you might know that the endoderm is one of the germ layers, which takes you right through. It's a gatekeeper cell, which takes you through to the pancreas, the liver, intestines, lung, thymus, for example. And as you can imagine, I mentioned pancreas. Well, some of you might know us as being a diabetes company. In fact, we have been, our primary focus is to create a cell therapy for diabetes using that technology, plus being able to go from the endoderm to the insulin-producing cell. In the last several months, we've been able to generate insulin-producing cells, which I think have surprised a lot of people. It's a very difficult thing to achieve, and we've very recently shown that these cells actually work in animal models of diabetes. So sounds great if you're a scientist, but it's a bit like you're in the first maybe 100 yards in a marathon. You know, we've got that far. We've got a lot to go. We've got to do a lot of work in developing these cells. And so that's our goal, obviously, to get into the clinic. In addition to that platform, we do have an encapsulation technology which would allow us to coat the cells that we generate to protect the cells, immunoprotect the cells, so they wouldn't have to be given to patients that would have to go under chronic immunosuppression. As you can imagine, a stem cell that's not autologous will be rejected. So this technology is kind of helpful. And then thirdly, we're also very interested in drug discovery capabilities, and because the endoderm is a very interesting germ layer, it's associated with many different cancers, for example. We have an active program looking at cancer stem cells linked to things like pancreas, lung, etc. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kai Pinkanell. I am the head of research at Sartori Therapeutics, and I think we're a little bit, Sartori Therapeutics is different from the other companies here on the panel. We investigate and use adipose-derived stem and regenerative cells, so an adult cell source for autologous therapy. And I think what another differentiator that Sartori has, I think, is the way we try to achieve this. We ultimately manufacture a device that allows the physician in real time to extract a stem and regenerative cell population out of adipose tissue in a very short time frame, within about an hour. The basis to generate the tissue is a small liposuction procedure, but you can see from this description that we have an autologous approach. We have adult cells that we use from adipose tissue, which is a heterogeneous population of cells. We do not select for a particular marker. And our major clinical applications to date are two major areas. One is plastic reconstructive surgery, where we augment a fat transplant that normally doesn't really work because it gets resorbed by the body, but we augment that fat transplant with the adipose-derived cells as a mix, which makes the fat transplant stick around. And the other big area is cardiac disease, where we look at ischemic heart treatments with an ongoing clinical trial in Europe and a heart attack treatment soon to start in Europe as well. So major thing is it's a device. There's no cell culture involved. Everything can happen at the bedside, which is the Sartori Therapeutics approach. Thanks.
I'm Steve Latterman from Agilent Technologies. I think we're even more different from the other companies on the panel. Agilent is focused on providing measurement solutions, including reagents, consumables, instrumentation, and informatics for profiling biomolecules and measuring biomarkers for use in research, in development, in QA, QC, and in medical diagnostics. Platforms that support one another of these segments include DNA microarrays, microfluidics, chromatography systems, mass spectrometers, and PCR. So these life science applications at Agilent are amongst the fastest growing businesses within the very healthy, roughly $2 billion bioanalytical measurement solutions business, which itself is about a little more than a third of Agilent overall. So we're very keenly interested in being sure that the products and services in use with stem cell researchers today are meeting the expectations of you all who are using them, and also very interested in being sure that our future offerings meet your needs. And so in addition to some important people from the sales force who are here in attendance, there's two people from R&D. Myself, I'm a senior manager in Agilent Laboratories, the advanced central research labs of Agilent, responsible for genomics, RNA and DNA diagnostics, and some nanotechnology measurements of relevance to biological sciences and material sciences. For example, my team was responsible for the early R&D that led to enabling our comparative genomic hybridization array-based assay and our microRNA profiling assay, both of which you can learn much more about in detail when time permits at the booth outside. Also here from R&D is Neil Cook, who is the Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for all of the bioanalytical measurement businesses, as well as Director of all of the molecular technology research within Agilent Laboratories.
I'll just give a brief introduction of Invitrogen. I'm Joydeep Goswami. I head up the stem cells business at Invitrogen. And our goal is very simple, right? We are, as somebody quoted in a magazine, the picks and shovels makers for stem cell research and therapy. So our goal of our group is really to enable stem cell research and therapy by providing tools and reagents around the entire stem cell workflow, be it isolation of cells, characterization of the cells, And then, of course, then further taking these cells and expanding them, just growing tons of these and differentiating them. And as you heard this morning from John Chestnut's talk, we're also actually enabling technologies that allow people to use stem cells themselves and their progeny as tools, right? So this would be really then taking these and making these more effective tools for drug discovery usage. And I think, Alan, you mentioned something around taking the endoderm. But really what we are pioneering is technologies that allow the cells to speak to you rather than, you know, having to probe them additionally with antibodies or other things. And our mandate actually expands to the therapy side of things because we're spending a lot of effort now making sure that the reagents, the media, the growth factors, et cetera, are suitable for therapy. So these are things such as, you know, what are normally called 510K reagents, and meaning that every component in the medium is defined, it's traceable, it's non-toxic, it does what it wants, what it has to do. So we're spending a considerable amount of time in that, and then, of course, it's really been an honor to collaborate with many of you here in the audience, both from the academic side, and I know we have relationships with most of the people on the panel here, in terms of taking some of the technologies that you've introduced and bringing them to market to researchers, and I think we'll continue to do so. So some of Cytori's cells are actually the adipose-derived stem cells will be introduced into the market soon. From us, along with the appropriate media, et cetera. Similarly, I think, Alan, from your side on the neural progenitor cells and some of the media that are associated. So I think that's our mandate, and I'll move on to the next set of questions here. So I think the first part of it, since this is a panel that's had a fair amount of experience both within California and outside, I know all of us probably have operations outside California as well. Maybe the first question is much more to do with, you know, what has been your experience at being a California company and working in California versus how have you experienced the research or the business of stem cells outside perhaps California or even outside the United States? And maybe, Kai, I'll let you start this off because I know you're running a fair amount of trials outside this country, so maybe you can start us off in that direction.
Yes. So Cytori is active. I would say we can truly say we're a global company. We have clinical trials ongoing in Japan and in Europe, which is, and I think it kind of encompasses a lot of the nuances about what we try to talk, which is how does the cell therapy look and how is it handled and how, what's the progress made in other companies and how do they fare with all the regulations and restrictions and how to let this technology into the market. I would say that definitely Japan is very different to the other countries, so the US here and Europe. Because of the way the society is currently structured, very much aging society, allogeneic transplantation is something that is not very much promoted in the society. So anything that has to do with autologous transplantations, organ transplantations, is much higher regarded. Due to the cultural differences, and Europe has, I think, embraced, at least on the adult stem cell side, the technology very much, and I think that, especially on the cardiac side, there are lots of clinical trials, lots of activity in Europe, which is ongoing, trying to move this field forward. One thing there is that each country within the European Union has a different set of regulations. So there is some considerable heterogeneity, which again has its own set of issues, I would say.
As you may know, we're centered in California. Our headquarters and origins are in California. Many of our businesses are centered in California, including our genomics and proteomics businesses. And among our most recent acquisitions, Stratagene, it's of course centered here in San Diego. At the same time, in the tradition of the Hewlett-Packard company from which we were spun out in 1999, we're a very global company with not just sales but manufacturing and R&D throughout the world in order that our products can best serve local requirements, in order that we can work with customers with a very clear understanding of the nuances in all of the different geographies, and in order that we can share the diversity of expertise and experience for all of our customers stemming from all around the world. I think one very tangible example of that in the research area that is of relevance to this community is our experience with customers and collaborations throughout America and Europe and Asia in the area of copy number variants are very directly and tangibly influencing the product designs and the tools that are available to this community here in San Diego to look at genome rearrangements. Something that touches on regulation, I think, although it's not about stem cells per se, as you may not know, the DNA microarray platform that Agilent provides is the foundation for the first multiplex test approved by the FDA. This is a gene expression-based test that is used for breast cancer prognosis put out by a small company in the Netherlands called Agendia. Certainly, this is an area where the regulations in Europe and the United States are quite different, even as both are evolving. And our experience in working with Agendia to get that test supported through them and by them for clinical use in Europe was certainly very foundational both for them and for us in understanding how to work together for the clearance in the United States.
So, you know, I think we've heard two different perspectives in Europe and Asia Pacific, I guess, and Japan in particular. Alan and Jeffrey, I guess, could you comment a little bit on, you know, the specifics of doing business in California, right, versus, you know, or collaborations, if that for that matter, versus, you know, elsewhere in the world, right? Because that's of particular interest, and I think much of the audience has heard these sort of things around, you know, Singapore taking over the world of stem cells because, you know, they're pouring tons of money into it. And, you know, when I visit Singapore, I mean, clearly they've set up great facilities there. But I still am pretty bullish about the U.S. and specifically California, seeing the amount of talent around here and the clearly the collaboration that takes place in and around the labs here, right? Can you comment a little bit of what you're seeing and kind of the difference it's making for you?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Obviously, just as NovaCell, we have relationships with a couple of folks in the Salk Institute up in UCSF, you know, major stem cell players in California. Obviously, we very much focused on a program which probably didn't need external support too much anyway, so we haven't done much in the diabetes space with some of these individuals, but we have lots of other opportunities in the liver, lung, and other organ systems that we're embracing and thinking about. The one thing I've only been doing this for a couple of years, or just under a couple of years, so, you know, when I joined it, I knew there were a few, unlike the rest of the panel, as you've heard, we are a human embryonic stem cell company, so there's the politics and ethics, which I think these other folks don't have to worry about. So, you know, where do I feel most comfortable? And it's the UK. I am British, but it's not because of that. There's a lot of, obviously, human embryonic stem cell research is ongoing there, and it's a pleasure to go there. There's a lot of activity. I like to go there. We're going to create a GMP cell line probably overseas, and, you know, the UK is an ideal spot because they've got GMP labs. They've got a lot of experienced individuals, especially in cell therapy. The rest of Europe is a bit thin. There's a little bit going on in Sweden, maybe a little bit in one or two other European countries. But it's very clear to me, other than on the East Coast where, you know, the Harvard community and one or two other locations, we are the center of the universe as it comes to stem cell research. And I also say development. One of our friendly competitors, Geron, is perhaps one of the most advanced embryonic stem cell companies. Hopefully they'll get their product into the clinic this year. ESI, as you pointed out in Singapore, has unfortunately sort of folded a little bit, though I think it's reinventing itself in the near term. So it's a tough space. It's very difficult to, we're not talking about money here, but it's a tough space to be in when you have there are very few of you out there. So it's very nice to work with friends and very bright ones at that in the California community and certainly in these institutions, the four that we've heard about today. It's tremendous talents, and of course the talents bring students, so we have a lot of students out of these labs, so it really helps us grow the company.
I'd like to talk a little bit about our collaboration with Russia, and it's interesting that in Russia they They have excellent scientists there, and they don't have the funds. And so it's a very good place to set up collaborations to get good science. And we found that through that collaboration, there were some issues that we had to work with as far as informed consent and getting the same sorts of standards that we have here working there. And that was a rewarding experience, actually. And the work that we had done in Russia was very well appreciated by the people in Russia, and they even got some comments from scientists that they see this as sort of like the space program, where you have good things coming out of a collaboration between the United States and Russia. I would like to say that in our California experience, it's been very good. We came here because of the excellent facilities and people and education that we could work with, and the hires that we've made here have been very good. And we've also worked in some regard with in Maryland. They have similar funds available for stem cell research, and so much of that is similar to what we find here in California. They're sorting out the issues with dividing the funds between the academic community and the for-profit community, and initially much of it going to the academic community. So in the last collaboration we've had with Canada, we've done work in Canada and successfully characterizing our parthenogenic embryonic stem cells. So we've been taking advantage of worldwide resources to pull together science, and I think that's one of the unique characteristics of this field.
Yeah, you know, Jeffrey, I think two observations on that, and maybe a general question to the panel after that as well. So one thing I guess all of us are finding is that when we go around the world, the differential that we used to see between the U.S. and the rest of the world in terms of, you know, temporarily at least, of how far behind a particular country was no longer exists, right? And I can tell you, I was just in Asia about 2 weeks ago, and you literally had the scientists there telling me, we don't want your money. We have more money than we know what to do with, right? And you're seeing them get the latest equipment and putting it into place. And I think that's I think what they don't have, and the only thing they don't have, which I think we have here, is a talented pool of scientists who are already, you know, trained in the art, as it were. And that's something we should keep in mind as we move forward, is that gap or the lead is not going to last very long, right? So all of the previous panel, and I think some of the questions that we'll tackle later in this panel, really should go towards, you know, getting the research done quickly, removing roadblocks for the research and, in fact, the clinical development to be done. But one question I had for the panel just on this U.S. or California versus outside California is, have you found it actually easier to get what you need to get done here than elsewhere in the world, right? Because that's really one of the key attractions of having the four institutions so closely located here is to get that talented pool enough to have access to that pool or infrastructure, if you will. So has that been your experience here, or it's kind of mixed in terms of how you would view it?
Well, I made the point that, you know, we've benefited by having these institutions. We've got Rusty Gage was on the panel, obviously one of the presenters this morning. We have a number of his students, just was one example. You know, there aren't too many people like Rusty Gage around the world that you can just pluck people and immediately they fit right into your organization. So I really think it's the talent pool which is the most significant thing that we access. And I think we benefit certainly as much here as we do as the people in San Francisco do. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. In terms of, you know, obviously there's a very great biotech community here. We sort of benefit to some degree in that, and obviously having access to CIRM eventually, the institute, which hopefully will be paid for by CIRM grants, where the four institutions will benefit. We hope we can tap into that. Maybe there'll be a GMP facility we could use at some point.
Yeah. So let me turn the question around, right? What do you think is something we lack in Southern California that, you know, you would wish it were here and that would take care of? And you know, anyone on the panel, I guess, can answer this.
Oh, unlimited funds, but I wouldn't mind. I like the sound
of
those Asian people.
I shouldn't have asked you that question.
Anything in terms of infrastructure? I mean, is it GMP facilities? Is it technicians that are well trained in the art?
Because I think you make a good point that you've used the word art a few times, and I know from people in my organization that stem cell research, especially to do with embryonics, there's a lot of art associated with it. It is not just a classic science. So, you know, obviously the more and more trained people we have, the stronger we'll be. So I don't think we have enough people. I think, you know, the grants, I think, are phenomenal. I think that's really going to give us a leg up, as it were. It's all to do with the people to start with, because I think a lot of the science of it is, to me, it's fairly early stages are okay. The secondary phase of actually developing a product where you need GMP facilities, you need a lot of the technologies which can cut you. We need vast numbers of cells to do what we're doing, billions and billions of cells. So the manufacturing capability in California, it's okay. You know, obviously the Genentechs and Amgens and Biogen IDEX of this world have created biologics facilities.
Right.
I'm sure we can create cell therapy type facilities based on that knowledge base, but probably not there yet.
Yeah. Anybody else on the panel?
Well, my comments really come back to the positive question that was asked first, or just a minute ago, regarding, I think, coupling to the observation that there are important advances and capabilities throughout the world. I think that what will distinguish locations are their ability to stay abreast of what's happening everywhere and integrate that knowledge, not just in the stem cell research area, but also in affiliated or even tangential areas of molecular biology. I mean, we see that, for example, that the tools that are being taken up in measuring, for example, genome rearrangements were really first developed for cancer researchers and cytogeneticists, but obviously are addressing questions of great importance to monitoring and characterizing, you know, different stem cell lines and even the variation in stem cell lines as they are propagated. And so I think it's the integration. And so what's happening here in Southern California strikes me as a very effective way of trying to build a larger critical mass of people to work on specific problems, but also to be aware of what's going outside their fields and outside this location to bring it into the activities mm-hmm. here.
I think I like that idea to try to incorporate different areas into what currently might be defined as a center of research or the central theme of research. I think there is a lot. Southern California has a big advantage in a lot of ways regarding money, people available, facilities available. But I think the true art, and I'm not sure, and I hope there will be more, is going to be to find the synergies between totally unrelated areas. It means the synergies between, for instance, industry and academics. And I think one cannot do without the other. There are pros and cons for each side. But I think the true progress will be made if the advantages of the different areas can be leveraged, and so that there is a synergy that will actually potentiate the outcome. That's how I would see it. And it, I think to say, are we there yet, or is everything perfect? I think it's never really perfect. You can always have more money. You can have more this, more that. But I truly think it's finding the right way to make most out of it, and especially with regards to academics and industry.
Yep. So let me switch gears a little bit, right? And I think quite purposely, I think this part of the panel was chosen because each of you probably has an emphasis on a different type of cell. And, you know, when I look at the world, it's, you know, I tend to split it up into embryonic and non-embryonic. And I know, Jeffrey, you have something now which is kind of in the middle of those two things in the terms of parthenogenetic lines, right? Tell us a little bit about, you know, what your experience has been, and I think, Alan, you alluded to this a little bit about, you know, being one of the companies dealing with embryonic stem cells, right? How has this impacted your ability to do business both, you know, inside California and outside, right? If you see some of this negative connotations with embryonic stem cells, and I think, Kai, on your side, right, if it has accelerated the fact that you're actually dealing with adult stem cells from, you know, fat tissue, whether it's actually helped you get access to more funds or access to more countries than would normally be the case.
Do you want to?
Oh, you go first if you like.
So the has it?
You've probably got more money than I have, so you can share with
me. Has it resulted in more funding or an advantage? I think everything has two sides to it. On the one hand, you could argue there might have been a concentration on, especially in California, to support embryonic stem cell research. On the other hand, you can argue that maybe in the rest of the world there has been a push to, you know, to increase research in adult stem cells as an as a alternative to embryonic stem cells. And so I think it's a mixed bag of things. Again, there are, I think in two fields there are synergies, and I cannot really say that it was one thing or the other. I think it was mixed.
Sure. I agree with what you said, especially, and that's why we've specifically designed our company, our strategy around providing research products through the Lifeline brand name to all segments of the cell culture industry, media, reagents, culture reagents, and that sort of insulates us against the adult stem cell, embryonic stem cell divide. But we have had direct experience with some difficulties with our collaborations with our parthenogenetic stem cells. In some cases, our collaborations were ended abruptly because of the uncertainty over whether or not there were working with an embryonic stem cell or a not an embryonic stem cell with federally funded equipment. So on a I can say on the research side, it's probably slowed us down a bit. But as a whole, because we're diversified, our company can weather that sort of an issue. So that's how we've addressed that particular issue.
Well, obviously, as I said a little bit earlier, you know, the ethics and politics of what we do very clearly is, you know, certain people are obviously opposed to what we do. I think the thing, what we're trying to do is to create a cell therapy for diabetes, for diabetics. And the only way you can really do that, in candidness, is to have a cell source which is inexhaustible, is the term that was used this morning, and that comes from human embryonic stem cells. There is no other source of these cells today that's been proven. So we have to forge ahead, and we believe that we've been able to achieve it. So I think we're a I like the term for-profit. I don't know when we're going to get profits, Duane, but I'd rather be a not-for-profit right now because it's going to take us a little while before we get a profit. But seriously, we are a company that you can raise money and you don't have to worry about NIH grants and things of that nature because, you know, whilst we have had access to them in the past, we're not going to get access to them anymore until maybe there's a change of government. But I think you just got to drive and focus on what we do. So we all hedge our bets a little bit. As I said to you earlier, we have three platforms. We do drug discovery, cancer stem cells, which is fairly non-controversial. But the real focus of this company is creating a cell therapy for diabetes. And I think the CSO of NovoCell was at a stem cell meeting in New York last week, and there was a panel discussion, and they were saying, the one thing we need is a cure. One of these stem cells has to show that we can cure a disease. And I think that will capture the imagination of more of the public. I don't care what it comes from, whether it's from an embryonic or an adult cell or a parthenogenetic cell. But we have to drive with where we are going to achieve that goal, and we think we have a good shot at it. It's going to take us longer than we wish, you know, or the investors want, but I think we are on the right direction. And, you know, the ethics of it and all the rest of it, I think, is secondary at the present time because we feel everything we've done has been above board and transparent to the community.
And maybe Jeffrey, you can give a little bit of information to the audience of, you know, how parthenogenetic lines or why international stem cell thinks it's, you know, substantially different from, let's say, where embryonic stem cells are, right? And perhaps why this could be less controversial, if at all, on that front. Because I know the IP situation is very different from the ethical situation,
yeah.
Right?
Well, parthenogenetic embryonic stem cells are derived from unfertilized eggs. So from that point of view, ethical issues are, we'll say, minimized. They have other advantages as immune rejection issues. They are matched, immune matched to the egg donor. So at least for the egg donor, those problems are eliminated, we believe. So a parthenogenetic embryonic stem cell from what our research and our first paper that we recently published in cloning and stem cells is shown to be pluripotent, forms teratomas, seems to be infinitely able to divide. And we're studying these things much closer. There are issues that we have to continue to study, imprinting issues, as everyone here probably knows. But we're very excited about this new source of stem cells, and because they minimize the immune rejection, number one, which I think is significant, and number two, hopefully the ethical issues will go away for us, and some of our collaborations can go forward. We've seen some exciting differentiation. You may have seen we have a corneal-like structure developed when we were making our retinal pigment epithelial cells. And so I think more of these sorts of exciting discoveries are going to be made in the next few years as we move forward. So,
So let me, you know, since this is a business panel, right, I'm going to put you guys a little bit through the fire in terms of seeing whether, you know, some of these therapies actually, one of the concerns is to make these affordable, right? And whatever affordable means at this point, you know, is a moot point. But still, as I look across the therapies and I see the simple device structure that Cytori is putting about with, you know, minimal manipulation, and then, you know, some of the more embryonic and even mesenchymal stem cell therapies that are closer to the market need a considerable amount of babying the cells and growing them over time, which does add to cost, right? And I've seen some of the costs of tens of thousands, if not more than that, for just getting a dose of cells to the patient for some of the more, you know, manipulated cell therapies. And how does that affect you as you think about the future, right? Of course, there is a lot of science to be done, but how are you thinking about these things in terms of final goal of having affordable therapies?
Well, I think if you can cure type 1 diabetics with a cell therapy, I think, you know, that's a huge value to the patient. And, you know, obviously there's a huge amount of costs associated with diabetes, not just insulin. Down the road, you know, the side effects of chronic hyperglycemia or poorly controlled glucose clearly has all sorts of negative side effects, from blindness to limb amputation, hospitalization. So I think we've talked to medical reimbursers, you know, about, you know, pricing a product is the most incredibly difficult thing. I'll state that up front. And I was with a company called Celgene that some of you might have heard. They have a drug called thalidomide, which is, you've also probably heard of, is probably one of the most negative connotations, because it causes birth defects. Well, that thing costs about $50,000 a year now. And that's an old small pill, but it saves people's lives. And, you know, so frankly, people will pay for it, and it's reimbursed. The question you're asking was how much will my cell therapy be? I don't know, you're not specifically asking me that.
No, I'm not asking that. It's more of what I was asking is, you know, does that impact how you're carrying out your development and as how you're thinking about things right now?
Well, obviously, the cost of developing this product, you know, is obviously we have growth factors, we have all the it's a multi-stage process. It's not just taking a cell out of the fat of a patient, spinning it down and putting it back into a patient. This is a lot more complicated. And so there is a cost to that. I think our product, we hope, is going to last for 2 years because we've got some evidence that you can encapsulate cells and put them into patients and they will last. So, you know, a two-year product which can do have all the benefits of, you know, taking people off insulin and reducing their potential liabilities down the road, I think will be very well accepted. And we've obviously talked to key opinion leaders in the diabetes space, and you know, there's an appetite for this kind of product. There's no doubt about it, because it is conceptually a cure.
Right.
I'm not saying I can't guarantee that today, obviously, but it is possible you can cure a very significant disease. So, yes, we think about it, but at the same time, I don't think we're really concerned about it. We don't think we're going to, tap out the healthcare service with this product, if that's what you're going to ask me. But a lot of people could be taking it because diabetes is such an important, it's an epidemic, and the type 1s is, you know, about a million or two, and then you've got type 2 patients, and a lot of them are also on insulin. So you could be talking about several million people here that are potentially able to take this product.
How about you, Kai? I mean, I think you guys are a little bit further down the line in terms of, you know, really getting to that product and having these conversations with insurance companies, et cetera, around the globe, right? How's that shaping up in terms of now that you're so close to a product, right, the thing of affordability versus, you know, efficacy or benefit to the patient?
This obviously determines our everyday life, that's for sure, or it's a big part of our everyday life. So all the clinical development and preclinical development is streamlined towards making this step from having an investigational therapy to a accepted and reimbursed therapy for the market. For us, it's a very real and a very imminent problem. And I think, you know, looking at the overall field, and I come from the physician side in cardiology, my driver into this area was pretty simple. Cardiology, although with all the, angioplasty, stents, bypasses, cannot really do, we can do much more for the patient than in the past, but still, you know, we are far from curing a patient, right? The only thing we do is we halt disease progression as good as we can, and oftentimes we cannot. We slow down disease progression. So while there is a big push, obviously, behind the cardiologist field, and there's a lot to be lot done and very on a very costly level to some degree, what always bothered me was there is no true therapy that makes a patient tremendously better other than heart transplantation, obviously, with a cost of immune suppression. So I think this is the driver. We, with our therapy, I think we're very near-term. We can, in a very short period of time, reach the market. And for us, it's very important to try to make our therapy affordable for the healthcare system, because we think that's what will make it successful. And this will obviously partially also depend on how much better can we make the patient, actually. What's the therapeutic benefit? And all this needs to be seen after the first clinical trials are in, but cost effectiveness is one of our major points that we try to develop, and we try to be very cost effective. What we ultimately want to sell is a cartridge and enzymes and things you need for the extraction, but that's what it's going to be. It's not going to be the GMP facility, which with potentially a limited production capacity and high costs associated with it. But there are, I think, two sides to the medal, and I think each field has its merits, but I think there is a disparity in the time to market. I think we're relatively close. We need to see what the therapeutic impact is going to be, and but there are other therapies who will come in the future.
Along those lines, one of our strategies, I think, that addresses these issues is cell banking. And with the cell types that we're developing, we're looking towards setting up banks of parthenogenetically derived cells that are undifferentiated, that can be used by other researchers to address different diseases. So imagine in the future, maybe 50 to 100 cell lines, and the math is often debated, and that's a difficult, with immunotypes that people can pull out and change to islets to use with the therapeutic modalities that a Nova cell is developing. And so that's another way of addressing the economics of this area of cell therapy.
You know, what's encouraging to me, I think, from Kai's comments and from Alan and your comments, I think really is that it's still the regulators and the insurers are still seeing this as a positive benefit overall. And I think the discussion, as you laid it out, Kai, is less about direct costs but more about, you know, what's the benefit provided. And I think one of the advantages of cell therapy, and especially stem cell therapy, is you can do things which you could not do before. And I think both of you have emphasized that, right? Yes, insulin's available. Yes, stents are available, but there's a quality of life. There's a duration of life issues in both of those things. So I'm I'm glad that that's actually going into the consideration here. Let me actually move on to the last topic of discussion, and I do want to leave some questions, question time for the audience. So I know all of you had a lot of things to say on this particular point, and I'm sure the audience, and especially members of CIRM in the audience, will have time to react on this. So now that, you know, CIRM's a reality, and I think most of the legal challenges are out of the way, how has your experience been with CIRM, the way it makes decisions? And, you know, this is a nice time to vent or ask for, you know, changes in how things are handled here. And also, I think particularly for the San Diego part of CIRM, the SDCRM, you know, what else should we be doing as a community to accelerate this field and actually, as you pointed out earlier, make San Diego the real hub for stem cell science across the globe. So I'll let, Steve, I'll let you start off because
I've been so I think that from our perspective, the kinds of things even that are happening today is a good example. For our perspective, communications are the most valuable thing so that we are apprised, so we know where we can help, so we can work on the right time scale to be helpful. I mean, even this topic that we just talked about, I think not just scientists and technologists, but even the agencies recognize that if something really different and important comes out of this, then making it more cost-effective will come in time through technologies that scale up, through technologies that leverage whatever in molecular biology to improve the transformations, through measurement technologies that will be a handle for improving yields and quality, anything of that sort. But I think understanding what the true timing is, what the true needs are now, and how they're likely to roll out in the future so that the various parties can coordinate in the right way, in a way that's mutually beneficial for everybody to play their role over time and develop for the future is really valuable.
So is a suggestion then having more of events such as this, you know, basically being sponsored, which gets the scientific community and the industrial community together?
Well, there are many ways of interacting. It needn't always be an event like this. So, for example, again, speaking, you know, close to home, there are interactions we have with customers that cover really a lot besides maybe sale of traditional products or existing products. There's sharing of new results. There's access to emerging methods. There's working together to provide background information for grants that may be in process. There are even customized products. Our DNA microarray products are made in a factory that's very cost-effective for both standard products and custom design products. There are a number of examples where we have worked with consortia to provide customized products that are actually only available to that consortia that are tailored to the needs of them. So I think consortia is also just an example of efficiencies, not just for the researchers within the consortia, but for interacting with third parties such mm-hmm. as us, and along many different channels.
Right.
But critical to any of it is mutual understanding to see what makes sense to do
Got
together
it.
And communication.
Got it. Kai?
So I think I would just like to add to the point that I made earlier. I think it's the trying to get the best of both worlds, the industry and the academic world. And I think suggestion, which is a good one, would be to have events like this, or could be smaller, any size or shape or form, where different people meet very different backgrounds, because I think from my experience coming from academic research going into the industry, there are many, many things I think the academic researchers could learn from the industry, and obviously the industry can learn a lot, get a lot of input, novel things out of the academics. But the earlier, and I think that will add to the success of the field overall, the earlier you start thinking about how to actually convert that into a clinically relevant, scalable, affordable treatment, the earlier to do this, and I think that's what industry can provide. The earlier you do this, the more successful and the faster the whole field's going to move.
And what could CIRM then, other than, you know, the events thing, is there anything in particular that you wish
really trying to bring strategic parties at the same table and really introduce and try to make the connections. I think it's really about bringing people with diverse backgrounds. If whatever some consortia member thinks about a certain constellation or has a certain idea, trying to have a pool of people that could come to the table, vet this, make a decision, or try to set up a collaboration. But I think the key there is to really have a timely turnaround of this and really easy access to people so that people don't think it's a burden, you know, people enjoy it, there is something in it for everybody. Sounds a little bit too good to be true, but obviously, I think that would be very, very helpful.
If I could, first of all, make one comment. I think we're incredibly fortunate having Dwayne Roth as our representative here in Senate. He keeps us completely clued in and aware of what's going on. I swear there isn't anybody up in Northern California who does the same thing. So keep on doing the good thing, Dwayne. But the thing that you mentioned today, it's a follow-on from what Kai was saying, I think this concept of a disease focus, I love the concept. I've heard it a couple of times, but what does it actually mean? And isn't it about time we started doing that? So, we've heard today people present about cardiovascular and CNS, and I've mentioned diabetes a couple of times, obviously, this afternoon. But when are we actually going to get together as a group, the smartest people in San Diego, maybe in California, and how do we really all work together to get the cure? Now, obviously, I have a stake in it, but I could imagine there are smaller indications where, there isn't kind of the same hype and aggression. That I think if we could do that, we would clearly, and whether CIRM should be the people to do that, they seem to be the right vehicle for that focus. Because when you said that today, I'm not clear, are people talking amongst themselves about this? Because we're not involved, and I'm not saying we should be, but it would be nice to know that industry, academics, other people in the patient advocate group, we're all together, and we have a chance to lead yet again in that area, I think.
Great. Okay. I was very happy to see the talks earlier today about how private industry is being brought into the funding. And so going into this, I wanted to talk about a little bit about accelerating that process, but it sounds like it's happening, and that's very encouraging, especially with the new lines, the planning grants, all of these disease teams, and that's excellent. I'd like to say one thing that private industry can bring to these collaborations at an earlier point in basic research is the mind towards scalability in manufacturing. I think we're currently doing a sponsored research project with a California institute where we're working together to look at the type of how are they differentiating the cells? Is that the right path to go down with a mind towards large-scale manufacturing and SOP writing and regulatory compliance? So the earlier you can bring industry into that process, I think the faster you'll get to a cure. That would be one thing that CIRM could do to help and encourage those sorts of earlier stage relationships.
Yeah. I think, first of all, I tend to agree with what's being said on the panel here. And I think one of the things of probably making the connections between the community here, even something like a simple directory or a database on, which scientists are working on what within the group, and I think one of the things, and we spend, I know each one of us spends a fair amount of time talking to scientists, trying to figure out what they're looking for, what are their problems, right? And I think maybe if this could be funneled up as part of SDCRM, as, here are the five things that are really impeding our research or therapy for that matter, right? And I think then, that gives industry a large chance to say, hey, this is what we should be putting our efforts on because this is what's really relevant. And while we can pick it up at an individual level, as I think the SDCRM and CIRM as a whole could really, accelerate and catalyze that effort. The other thing which has not been mentioned at the panel, and I think CIRM is doing a fair amount to train people. In fact, the first grants were training grants, right? But I think rightly so, we've started at the top, right? It's the postdocs and the graduate students. And I think one of the things, if I look around, I think we can get, there's a good enough pool for the high-level scientists right now, right, at least in Southern California. What is really lacking is the technician level people. And I cannot emphasize how important that particular group of people is to really pulling the entire space of science together and moving it forward. And I think there, you know, in some way, if CIRM could catalyze that and SDCRM could catalyze that, so there's this pool of people that are well-trained and can really take labs up to speed very quickly, I think that would be a big help. And I think, you know, some of the work that you're doing to accelerate the funding to industry would help. I think the third piece I would say is really making it mandatory to have a certain portion of grants that go to industry academic collaborations, right? And I think to make that mandatory will force the two groups to talk to each other a lot more and come up with solutions that are, you know, good both on the research end and on the therapeutic end. So those would be my three comments on that panel. Anyways, I think if there are no other comments, I'll open the floor to the audience here.
So, Joydeep, I wanted to respond to some of those last comments and make sure we get people energized around these. First of all, on the disease teams, the concept that has been laid out would be that these planning grants will help CIRM or the ICOC figure out what they ought to be. So if you get 20 proposals and look those over and say, it appears that diabetes, cardiac, whatever, are the kinds of places we want to go to put proposals out there. The breadth and depth of who those collaborators are, I think, will weigh very heavily and very positively on the ICOC. So I encourage industry to get together with academics on the planning grants and make sure that those kind of things come in. So that's one thing I wanted to comment on. The second and last comment about workforce. I think you may know that we've had now three presentations from the Cal State University proposal to do exactly what you're talking about, to train the technicians and the people to work in this field. The problem that we've run into is that we don't have a way to accept solicitations for grants. So we'll have to turn that around and turn it into a proposal that will be open to a larger group. But the sense of the board, if you read the transcripts, is very favorable. There are a few exceptions, but if there were a vote taken, that would be funded.
Yep.
So I think there's a strong desire to make that happen.
You know, Duane, I think one thing I would say is, and we've actually worked with the Cal State system and also with the Buck Institute to try and, you know, put something together, and I think industry as a whole could be a useful participant in that as well, right? Because many of these people will eventually move into industry. So absolutely, I think I can speak for all my panel participants here, is we would be very much interested in helping write that proposal and making sure that it's, you know, it's effective from both ends, right?
And it would be extremely helpful for the board to hear those comments. Right now, you've got Cal State representing it.
Yep.
It, as I said, it's getting, you know, meeting after meeting, some attention, but it would be good to hear others weigh in to that, like industry.
Sure.
The last point I want to make about this division between industry and academics, one of the more powerful movements I've seen on the board is to always consider industry. And that comes largely from the patient advocates. They love research, but they want to be cured. And they see it as a means to an end. And they're very, very supportive of any vote that's been taken where industry should be able to participate has been nearly unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not worry about how much goes where, because I think you're going to get a chance to participate in most of these ideas.
Makes sense.
I just wanted to follow up on Joydeep's point by making a suggestion to CIRM, perhaps, that there be the equivalent of the UC Discovery model for funding industry-academia collaborations. And that, I think, works very well, where you get 50% funding from the state, 50% from industry, and you end up getting more bang for your buck. And I think that's more likely to end up in translation of our discoveries into the clinic, which is clearly something I care a lot about, and I think most of the people in the room are driven by. So I think that might be an existing model that can be used.
I actually had a comment as well, if I may, which was that the point Duane was making earlier about how do you and we've been trying to do this, how do you actually build some connections between industry and science? The room is not as full as it was. You know, when the scientists were here doing their posters, and it was wall to wall, they were in the aisles and so on. Maybe they just had their lunch and left, but the fact remains that we need to find, I think there needs possibly, there may be worthwhile to explore some ways of actually keeping them in the conversation when it goes to ethics or business or anything like that. I'm not quite sure what that is, but there must be some solution. Perhaps you'd leave a suggestion in a box on the way outside. That'd be really. No, the scientists are working at their benches. Did you want to say something?
I am sure that we are all looking forward to products, but before we get to that stage, FDA is a is an obstacle. So I wanted to ask the panelists, especially from Saitori, to comment on that. Yeah. What's been your experience dealing with FDA or planning for an FDA approval?
That's a pretty broad question. So I think FDA has allowed the first trials into the clinic. Obviously, that is ongoing in adult stem cell research, right? Other countries in the world, especially Europe and Asia as well, but Europe has, I think at least the space where I'm dealing with, has the largest, longest clinical trials to date. So they have been a little bit earlier and have allowed a little bit more. Currently, also these countries actually try to clamp down on the regulations a little bit and try to make it more, a little bit better to understand that you have one person or one agency to go to get your approvals in the European region. Here in the U.S., you know, I think FDA is trying to do the best job it can to keep everything safe, and I think that's something everybody also needs to keep in mind, which was the first also in the adult stem cell area, which is less controversial, maybe even safer, but who knows, where a lot of products were wanted to go out in the first clinical trials, but obviously you have to show if it's safe or not. And I'm not sure, the field overall is very young, and I think it just takes a lot of education by everybody, educating each other, what's safe, what are the boundaries, you know, what's really a concern, what's not a concern. I just think it's a process that takes some time. But the overarching goal, and I think FDA has done a good job on that side, is to keep it safe for everybody.
If I just could mention something, the diabetes is a little interesting, a bit different from these other indications, because there is a cell therapy for diabetes. It's the Edmonton protocol, where you take cadaveric islets and you put them into patients' livers, and patients have, you know, been 5-6 years with this kind of therapy. So the FDA is familiar with that. But, of course, they're not so familiar with embryonic stem cell-derived products. And as you rightly point out, there's certain safety issues which they're concerned about. But we've had meetings with the cell therapy division, and they're very positive. They're excited. It's new. It's different. They're going to be cautious. There's no doubt about that. And it'll probably take longer than we'd hope. But I think they're ready to take on these products. I think they feel that this will make a huge difference to medicine, and they'll be working with us. I'm pretty convinced of that.
Yeah, you know, I'll just comment on the reagent side of it, because I think the FDA in particular has been fairly open at discussing some of these issues, right? And rightly so, their first concern is safety, right? But they haven't said things like, you know, an animal product in there makes your therapy unviable, right? What they're really saying, and this goes back to this 510K sort of thing, right, is make sure you can prove that you can trace the materials, that it's non-toxic, et cetera. So, and one also always has to trade off, and I think they're making the right kind of decisions here. You know, if you clamp down too hard on disallowing certain reagents, it does have an impact on the cost of the therapy, right, and the kind of infrastructure that has to be set up before the therapy hits the market. And of course, there's a gradation of, you know, what the alternative is, right? For things like cancer, obviously, you know, every month you delay the treatment, and many people are dying. If it's something more cosmetic or whatever, right, it might be less. It might be a much higher hurdle. But I do think the regulatory agencies are approaching this in the right manner, and we'll hope that that continues to be the case.
Yeah, our experience with the FDA and the admittedly much more straightforward situations of IVDs is that, as they say themselves, really the key is to have the conversation with them early, and often.
Joydeep, there's another.
Sure. I have a related question in terms of characterization. Cells being a lot more complicated than an inorganic molecule or a protein or even DNA, they're alive, they're changing. How do you know what you're putting in today is the same product you're putting in tomorrow or to a whole population of patients? So what I want to ask is, what type of technology and engineering would be needed to develop a way to easily characterize cells?
So, you know, I know on the research side we're dealing with a lot of this, and I think both of you should comment on the therapeutic side, right? On the research side, obviously, you know, you're right, right? Even for things that we put out, characterization of not only the cells but even the products that touch the cells is a lot more complicated for stem cells. But the very nature that these are one of the only cells that, you know, can self-renew but also can transform or morph themselves into other kinds of products, right? The way I'll speak for Invitrogen, the way we're approaching it is looking at characterization from multiple multimodalities, right? So you look at, you know, the obviously morphology of cells, but then looking at the protein side of things with antibody surface markers and intracellular markers. You look at it from the gene expression point of view through PCR and qPCR sort of things. But now, as you saw some of the presentations this morning, right, increasingly people are finding that epigenetic tools such as microRNA or histone modification or some of these things are also becoming important, right? So you will start seeing more of a slew of papers where you start looking at all of these three things together and getting a better idea of here's the state of the cell passage 1, here's the state of the cell passage 10 or whatever have you. And, you know, I think it's very unlikely that there will be no drift, right? Things change as you grow them outside the body. But I think one has to at least keep tabs on how the cells are changing or modifying. And then at the end of the day, I think especially for the therapeutic side of things, you are going to have to see some kind of a functional validation, I think, at the end of the day, right? Which is very different from just seeing markers. I mean, are you able to differentiate it down? Are you able to see? And I think one of the biggest parts that is ignored right now is seeing the effects in small animals, right? The in vivo studies, the ability to track cells and using tools such as, you know, Q-trackers or fluorescent proteins or the like, right? Seeing how they behave in this particular environment. And that's another level of characterization, really, if you think about it. Alan and Kai, I think.
Well, I think you pretty much summarized it. You know, obviously, it's going to be a dynamic process. Surface markers is what we do today to select our populations of cells. And we do, you know, qPCRs, just as Joydeep mentioned. But, in some years' time when, you know, the FDA is going to get more sophisticated about how best to deal with this process, it will change. So I think what we have today will change within 5 to 10 years. There's no doubt about it. So I can speculate, but I don't think there's much point in that at the moment.
Yeah, so I think there are a few aspects to this that I have asked myself over time. One of them is we always behave and oftentimes present things as if we would know what was really going on. I think in a lot of disease indication, we have no clue. And that obviously makes it very difficult. And since a lot of the downstream effects, the side cascades that could go on, overwhelm the initial blockage, whatever you want to create as a scenario, we do not know a lot of things. So at that point, that's kind of my stance, is you need to be practical and pragmatic, I think. If we would have waited for to identify the cell in bone marrow transplants that is responsible for repopulating the bone marrow, maybe right now we would start with bone marrow transplants. But no, we haven't done that. We do this for 30 years. So that's kind of how I would approach it. I think we need to do everything we can to make it as safe as possible. But I can tell you, if I see a heart failure patient after a big MI or who has other reasons for having heart failure, if he's in a late stage heart failure class, he has a mortality of 20% per year. All right, I have to say most likely after 5 years that patient's not going to be around. So if I can ensure to a high degree of certainty that my cells are going to be not do anything very harmful during that period of time, I think that's kind of a way to approach this kind of problem. There are definitely a lot of patients, a lot of disease indications with extremely bad and short-term, obviously, mortality, which are existence to date. And there are definitely strategies in testing out safety of... There are a lot of preclinical models which are very good, showing you if something's overtly wrong, but then there are also patient populations that can be tested which have really a bad, bad outcome if you don't do anything.
Jeffrey or Steve, do you want to add something? Any other questions from the audience?
No, you won't.
Quick follow-up comment is that is it too far-fetched to think that now California has taken a first step and has been very successful, is coming up with the equivalent of an NIH that funds research here? Do we want an equivalent of an FDA as a regulatory agency to facilitate approval of CIRM-funded products?
No. You know, we've been through this. And there is a California Food and Drug Administration. I don't know if you know that, but there is. And it was set up during the HIV crisis for exactly that purpose. But the federal FDA will never allow you to market that product just in the state of California. That is just not going to happen. So all it does is create duplication. And I think you don't want that. It's hard enough the way it is.
There was a comment I think Catriona made a bit earlier, but I might have misinterpreted what you were saying, but it was if there was some clinical trial with some of the products which CIRM might support, that the plan should go to an oversight committee or something to do with CIRM. Did I detect what that was your comment, your point?
Yeah.
Isn't that adding additional sort of...
I think that
bureaucracy
we do need I think that we do need additional oversight when it comes to embryonic stem cells, because I think that they, well, at least from what I've seen in the lab, they have obviously pluripotentiality, which makes them a little different than adult-derived stem cells. I think that that's why they will be very useful clinically, and I think that maybe that will improve the ejection fractions of the patients who have heart failure, for example. So instead of a 6% increase in their ejection fraction, as you saw with the STEMI trial, it may be a much more clinically meaningful increase in ejection fraction. But because of that pluripotentiality, because of the capacity to form teratomas or teratocarcinomas, because we know that 30,000 of our hematopoietic stem cells circulate per day, and that these cells have the capacity to invade into areas that normal adult stem cells don't, they don't pay attention to the normal tissue architecture, that we maybe need to have another step, another level of scrutiny that will keep us safe. So just like we do, so for example, when we do clinical trials, we have our IRB, and in some institutions, that's not considered to be sufficient. So for example, at Stanford, they have a scientific review board as well to look at the rationale behind that clinical trial. What's the science behind it? So what I was suggesting for the ICOC was that that would be the equivalent of the scientific review, in a sense, or the overview, but on a California-wide basis, so that we don't have to recapitulate that at each institution, and so there's some uniformity. And the other reason I was suggesting that is because of what the trials that have already been done in bone marrow transplant, and of course these are curative, 60% of people with de novo AML who have a bone marrow donor are cured by that transplant, and the statistics are similar for ALL. So there certainly is a long experience with bone marrow transplant. But I think that what's happened with adult-derived stem cells, including with bone marrow transplantation, is the conditioning regimens differ, the cell dose differs, the way that we introduce the cells differ, and I think what the ICOC could help us do, or some other overall governing body, is to say, okay, let's at least try and come up with a uniform dose, start off clinical trials that will be in some centers in California before we go nationally and perhaps internationally, so that we don't have the variability that we've seen with the cardiac, I'm just using that as an example, but with the cardiac trial. So it makes it very difficult to compare the STEMI trial to other trials. And you see three publications in the same journal with very different results.
So. On that note.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.